From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the mid-1990s in the favelas of Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. There were parts of the city that were essentially dominated by armed gangs, and a man named Dominic Barter developed a new approach to working with people in those areas, in those neighborhoods. He called it restorative circles, and he defines a restorative circle as a gathering of people who are experiencing painful or violent conflict. They come together to reestablish their ability to hear each other. Then they try to understand what the good reasons are for why bad things might happen. In other words, what are the common values that might motivate someone to commit an act of violence or theft or otherwise? And finally, they discuss what they can do next to improve the relationship. Now, maybe this sounds way too idealistic to you, but restorative circles have traveled to more than 40 countries. And this week, Dominic Barter is visiting Rochester once again. He's leading a public event tomorrow night at the First Unitarian Universalist Church in Rochester, and he's meeting with students and teachers this week as well. But first, he is my guest for the hour on Connections, Dominic Barter, the creator of Restorative Circles. Great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us in studio is Ruth Turner, who is Executive Director of Student Support Services for the Rochester Central School District. Ruth, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
And Kit Miller is the Director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester, which is one of several organizations that is supporting this visit for Dominic Barter this week. Kit, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Evan.
Dominic, I'd like to start with you. This is your we were trying to figure out before the hour. I think your third visit to Rochester now, yes?
Yes.
Well, welcome back here. Nice to see you here. And before we kind of talk about what's going on this week, I do want to just establish for listeners what it is that you do. And for the skeptics who think, can you really do this? Every time we talk restorative justice or restorative practices, there is an element of some skepticism among some listeners. So let's take us back to the mid-90s, where you were, what was going on, and the approach that you decided to bring to that.
Yeah, well, the first thing I think is to say that I'm so glad that there's so much skepticism, because justice is such a profoundly important aspect of our societies that it really can't be messed with ideologically. It only needs to change when we actually see proof that change is possible and necessary and beneficial. So in the situation in Rio in the 90s, but unfortunately in many aspects still today, mm-hmm. we had a society profoundly divided amongst itself. People who identified each other as being beyond the possibility of dialogue, beyond conversation and understanding. And arriving there in love with a Brazilian, wanting to live there and make my life there, I had a really huge challenge. Would I accept the part of the city that was given to me to live in, or would I attempt to actually live in the whole city? And to do that, I needed to work out a way to be able to establish relationships with those I was told were dangerous, were immoral, were people who I shouldn't see myself as being part of or identify with. So that was my task, really, to find out what I could do. And I came across a very, to me, surprising idea, which is that my security in the city, my physical safety and well-being, would actually be increased if I moved towards the places that others told me were most dangerous. Because by moving towards conflict, that conflict actually reverted to a conversation, which is what it was originally. People attempting to reach out to each other and say, hey, I'm not okay with this. I'm not okay with this because perhaps I don't have the resources to be able to live well, or I'm not okay with the way that I'm being seen because that marginalizes me in some way. So by moving towards these places and listening rather than just expressing myself, I discovered that there were so many people who had so much that they wanted heard and needed heard. And the more that they were heard, the less they had any interest in using any use of violence or anything that would harm or frighten anybody else. And really, that's how the work began.
What did your friends and family say about this mentality of kind of going against the grain, of saying, I want to move toward where, you know, I want to move in a direction where society is telling me, well, you have the means, don't go there, don't travel right there, don't live there?
It was actually only possible to do by not telling my friends what I was doing. When I first began to speak about it, people were just very, very worried. They thought, this doesn't make sense, you're putting yourself in danger. And the idea that that could actually increase one's safety was very counterintuitive for me as well. And I think in many places in our lives we see the same thing. It just makes sense not to drive down that street or not to visit that part of town or not to hang out with that group of people. But it's only when you actually do, with the specific intention to create understanding, that you actually find out why that danger exists in the first place and what that danger is attempting to achieve.
In reading and listening to some of your past comments here in Rochester and in other places regarding these kinds of practices, I think, number one, to me, it shows a respect for all people as human beings. And sometimes what we do is we reduce people to, well, that part of town, or, you know, as you said, that street, or those people. And it kind of reduces or eliminates their humanity. And you certainly are embracing everyone as people. That doesn't change the fact that there might be moments where someone is so distressed with their circumstances that they've committed crimes or resorted to violence that you might feel in danger yourself. Were you ever? Did you ever find yourself in danger?
Yeah, just a few weeks ago, I was held up at gunpoint. The school that I've been working with also lost its equipment in a robbery. These are very normal things, and at the moment in Brazil, our political situation is very complex. Mm-hmm. Last year, like so many places in the world, we had a big traumatic change of government, and a lot of people are in really dire straits around their physical well-being and access to resources. So, of course, those situations emerge. And the question is, how do we respond when they do? How do I respond immediately to the people in front of me? And then what are the stories that I tell to others about my experience of that happening? And then what do we do as communities to increase community safety rather than to increase the division and separation?
I want to go back to the 90s in a moment, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, when you're held up at gunpoint, how did you react to the people holding the gun?
We had a good conversation, and we decided what of my resources that I was carrying we were going to distribute. And I know that sounds almost humorous to say it that way, but that really is the most accurate way to describe what happened. And I don't think it's a coincidence that that we left on really good terms. And when I say good terms, I don't just mean increasing our safety, but in terms of there really being no animosity. I'm not interested in defining another person by the superficial characteristics that are the first thing that I see. I'm interested in establishing a relationship with that human being. I live with them. You know, those kids who held me up, they're my responsibility, even though they're not directly part of my family. So their well-being is just as important as my well-being. And that's the way I want to end my day, having had relationships that increased our safety and our well-being and our understanding of each other.
Now, typically, the average person in that scenario, well, there's no average. I mean, some people run, some people fight, some people say, I'll give you whatever you want, just get out of here, and then they call the police. I'm imagining you're conversing in a very different way, that you're telling them that you care about them, that you want. Did you ask them questions?
Well, the first thing is I'm more selfish, perhaps, than people who choose other strategies. I'm really interested in leaving there in good terms myself. I want my physical safety looked after. I want to live long and look after my daughter and do my work. So I'm not interested in doing anything that increases the danger. And what I found is that any animosity, any adversarial dynamic in that situation increases the danger. So the first thing I'm doing is making sure that I'm well.
Okay. And then are you talking to them? Are you asking them just to, you know, are you asking them what they want? Are you asking them anything about themselves?
Yeah, the first thing I want them to know is that it's safe enough for them to be able to put away the guns, because as long as they're holding a gun to my head, then they're in much more danger than I am in terms of anybody else who might see what they're doing. So that's the first thing I want to make sure that they know, is that this is not a situation where they need to use physical force in order for me to consider their needs and their well-being.
Okay. And did they do that? Did they put the weapon
they
away?
They yeah.
did.
Yeah.
Okay. And then after they put the weapon away, what do you do?
So then I'm interested in making sure that we're understanding each other. And that's just the same as in a restorative circle. I don't want to presume that message sent is message received, because there are so many different reasons I might have to filter their message, to interpret it, to misunderstand it. So I want to make sure that I'm really, really understanding them. So just like a pilot talking to the control tower when they're landing a plane, I want to make sure that the message that is sent is reflected back so that we know that we're on the same page. We don't presume that we're understanding each other. So the first thing to do is just to check that I really understood what was going on and what it was that they wanted.
Okay. And how long did you have a conversation before you parted?
Oh, this all has to happen pretty quickly.
Sure, of course.
Yeah,
I assume.
We probably only had about 15, 20 seconds together.
Okay. All right. And, you know, Dominic, there will be people who say, well, what you've done is encourage them to do that to other people, that they think that they can get away with that, and that it's the wrong lesson. What do you say to that?
Well, I have never actually met, it's been 21 years now that I've been doing this work, whether in prison or in a police station or in a school or on the street, I've never met anybody of any age who prefers to behave in ways that increase the risk for themselves and to other people. What I've met is people who say there's no choice. There's no other way. I have no other option. So my curiosity is to see how can, even in a very, very small amount of time, we establish the principle that actually there is choice about what's happening. So in that situation, I'm pretty confident that I'm not encouraging what's happening, because by not justifying the use of force by resisting, the only thing they have is their own distaste at the way they're behaving.
Okay. So let's go back to then the mid-1990s, and you're approaching the world that you're living in a way that says you don't want to put up walls, you want to bring more people together. How did you first create a restorative circle? I mean, how did you create, do you remember the first time?
Yeah, I started walking to favelas close to where I lived because those were the places that had been identified by others as where I shouldn't go.
Right.
And it was difficult to establish any kind of conversation with people because, you know, folks are busy. They've got work to do. They've got house cleaning to do. They're on their way somewhere. But the people who were hanging around who did have time for me were kids. So the first group that I started speaking with and the first beginning of a restorative circle happened with a group of 7-8-year-olds. So at that age, they're running their first errands for the gangs. The gangs at that time were the largest youth employer in the city. And for many families, there was encouragement for their children, especially the male children, to start to go into gang work, basically just to complete the family income. So
even that young, 7-8 years old.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And generally, after the age of 9, it's for a 10-year period, it's very, very hard for anyone to leave the gangs. I didn't know that at the time, but these were the kids who were hanging around on the curb. So we started chatting and after a while establishing a relationship, naturally they'd start celebrating things. They'd start telling me the good stuff that had happened to them. And I noticed that if I celebrated with them, then there was this connection, this energy between us, which changed our relationship. And if I didn't, it wasn't there. And at other moments, they would lament something. They would, you know, they'd moan about something. They'd complain about something. And again, it was an opportunity for me to be connected to their experience or not, and that made all the difference. So I started being interested. Okay, so how can I be happy that someone else's football team won, even if it wasn't my team that won? Because when that happens, there's a sense of companionship, a sense of brotherhood that emerges. And then even more tricky for me, what happens if someone is talking about a difficult moment in their life? How do I connect to that in a way that they experience they have company? So one of the things that they would bring up that they lamented was some situation of conflict, usually domestic. You know, oh, my sister was fighting with me yesterday and, you know, I'm upset with her and I don't know what to do. But sometimes it was more serious, a community issue involving perhaps the conflict between the police and the gangs or something else. And I thought, how can I sit with someone in their experience of conflict without trying to change it, make it go away, you know, be some kind of authority in this relationship, because I don't know these kids, I'm just arriving. And my intention is to listen, not to be talking about my stuff. So it was my experience of trying to be with people who were suffering the experiences of painful or violent conflict that really initiated the work. And that's the research I'm in 20 years later. I'm still trying to work out how to sit with people who are suffering the consequences of misunderstanding, of distrust, of separation, of hate and misunderstanding, of that profound choice to see the image that I have of someone else rather than to see them as someone who I need to listen to in order to know. So the first restorative circles were usually about domestic issues, very simple. But over time, the process grew in its ability to be able to contain more complex conflicts. We found that yeah, we needed to check each other's listening, but we also needed to go into the deeper sense of what's underlying that conflict, what's really at stake here. So I know on the surface we're fighting about the fact that someone trod on someone else's new tennis shoes, and that's like new trainers, and that's a big deal. But underneath, what are we talking about? And then we'd start to get, all right, belonging, sense of community, being seen in a community way, and being somehow validated by folks. And And then we started to get into, well, what needs to happen to change this? And then everybody would come up with the community solutions that already existed, that the drug gangs already did perfectly well, expelling people from the community, a bullet through the hand if you had been caught stealing, or unfortunately worse, when they believed that you were beyond change. And we started to look at how can this circle gathering, how can it respond to those situations as well? So the process grew slowly over time, and it continues to grow to this day.
Did you have any challenge or difficulty in convincing some people in those communities to sit down in a circle, to decide that they wanted to be part of that discussion? Is that a challenge?
It would be if that was my intention, but it's never been my intention to get people to do anything. This is a process that emerged based on what we found worked. There was never anyone kind of sitting at home and having a brilliant idea and then going and testing it out, needing to convince other people. And to this day, we encourage people to build restorative systems, not by learning what this is beforehand and then trying to apply it, but by asking questions. What currently works when you confront challenging situations? What works when you have painful conflict? What doesn't work? And answering those two questions, you get a lot of information. People have a lot of deep experience of living with conflict. It's just they haven't been asked to access it and think of it as being practically useful. Once people have asked those questions, then we ask them, so if it was just the way you'd like it to be, like if it was so kind of shiny and good and just like aligned with everything that makes you who you are as a group of people, then what would it look like? And they come up with these extraordinary ideas, this intuitive, deep, rich, nuanced sense of what it is that we need to create. And that means that no restorative circles work is the same. Even in schools that are neighbors, the process is subtly different in each place because it's responding to the unique culture of each group of people.
We're talking to Dominic Barter, who is the creator of Restorative Circles, which is an approach that started, as you're hearing, in Rio in the mid-90s, where he was living, and still living today, yeah?
That's right.
Okay, and that work has been going on for more than 20 years. This approach has spread to more than 40 countries. He's been to Rochester now 3 times, and he's here this week as a guest of, among others, the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester. And the director, Kit Miller, is here, who I know, Kit, you've heard him tell these stories before, but I'm struck by the point he just made, which is that he didn't create this notion of restorative circles in Rio and says, okay, this is going to work in Rochester and England and Russia and anywhere else it goes exactly the same way. But have you seen in Rochester this approach sort of in practice here? How would you describe it?
I think the idea of gathering people up and developing the critical skill of finding out first what happened, you know, that the skill of like, what's the observation, what actually happened here, and getting past the, well, she's a jerk or he's a this, but no, what actually happened between two people? And then, you know, what was it like for you that it happened? And then what can we do about it? Who and also looking at who is affected. I mean, this is the work that, you know, we're privileged to do in 5 schools every day. And I know, Ruth's team at RCSD is supporting every school in the district now to take these kind of approaches. And I think they're important. They build, they dismantle our systemic conditioning to blame, judge, criticize, punish. They support moral development, which I think is fairly critical. It supports our ability to be empathic with each other. And it opens up new and creative possibilities. So people have a different sense of experience of, oh, when I have a problem with someone, it's no longer a disaster. It could be an opportunity. I was really excited last year, a young man who was a former Rochester resident is now doing this work in Chicago. And the school is there. And he was really involved with a lot of activism in Chicago. And it was exciting, the activism that they were doing. And I said, geez, Jason, what's going on that with this activism in Chicago among all these young people? It's so exciting. And he goes, it's a lot of them found their voices in the restorative processes in their schools. So I think of this as social. We're like building a new social capital among young people who know probably better than their elders, many of them, how to deal with their stuff. And I know it was very exciting to be recently over at Northwest Northeast, the Douglas campus, in the Help Zone space over there, and to hear from Brandon White, who runs that room, that he has kids to come in now, and they're like, we just need the space. We need to do a circle. He doesn't need to be helping. So that's utterly possible. If we empower young people, they know how to do this. And as Dom said, they're sensible. They would rather do it this way if they know they can and they get the support and they get the encouragement, they'd rather do it this way. So that's why I'm so grateful to Ruth and to, you know, all the other visionaries in the city schools especially, who are really, you know, been pushing for this process over the years. And, you know, we've got to keep it moving because it's critical.
What a remarkable story about the kids saying, we just need the space, we got this. That shows that a cultural change is taking place.
100%.
You know, and as Dominic describes, if a child grows up and the culture is, you're caught stealing, it's a bullet through your hand, and violence is a part of the culture, it's going to take some work to change the culture that says, we're going to need a circle here. But it shows that it can happen.
And actually, sometimes people who've grown up with direct violence, they get the need for it faster because they are well aware that this could be life or death. There's no such thing as a little argument when there's guns around. So I actually think that sometimes people who are coming out of the most distressed backgrounds often are the ones who are like, oh yeah, I need to know how to do this because this isn't just an idea. This is the difference between life and death.
Yeah, and maybe a great desire to see that culture change. I'm going to get to your phone calls because I know Hal has a question on restorative circles and can they be used in prisons as an example. So we're going to get to that phone call in just a second. Listeners, if you want to weigh in on restorative circles, restorative practices, if you've got questions, if you're a skeptic, Dominic says he loves talking to skeptics. In fact, skepticism is a very valuable thing with this because we have to see what works. Evidence-based is good. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Want to remind you that there is an event tomorrow night, and they'd love to see you there. It starts at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Universalist Church. That's at 220 Winton Road South in Rochester. And Dominic's going to be, well, Kit, you want to just give us a quick overview here?
Yeah, yeah. At the Gun Institute, we've been really investigating the issues of hate since last spring, just with so much of the rhetoric and so much of just what's going on. It just seemed like an important underlying issue to look at. It seemed to be underneath so many other things. And some of the qualities that I just named that restorative processes help to support with human beings, the moral inquiry, empathy, creativity. Those are some of the things that I think of our medicine for hate, you know, medicine for that, our ability that we've been socialized to accept now that some people are throwaways, some people are irredeemable. So I'm really excited to have Dom here tomorrow because no one can articulate this stuff like he can, as you've already discovered today. Why going with a more restorative approach on a community level, like let's take it out of the schools. And Ruth and I have discussed, you know, this with others. Mm-hmm. Let's take it out of the schools. We need a community approach to this. And even if our country or even if our state is going in a different direction, we can claim the space of this community and do something different.
All right. That's 7 p.m. tomorrow night. And they'd love to see you there at the First Unitarian Universalist Church. And Ruth, I just want to make sure that we outline for our listeners as well, because this hour is vanishing quickly.
It is.
It always happens. But Dominic is going to be speaking to students, to teachers, and restorative practices is something that the Rochester City School District was moving into before the change in the code of conduct, which got a lot of attention last year and for good reason. But what have you seen when it comes to restorative practices in schools pre and post code change?
We have been really encouraged by some of the results. Kit mentioned about the story of the gentleman she knows from Chicago, but we're excited to hear our young people talk about circling up in terms not only to resolve conflict, but to build communities, to celebrate, to address concerns within their school communities. We're fortunate to our teacher union, our Rochester Teachers Union, for hosting our dinner seminar today, which is going to bring about 400 educators to be able to come together to learn and grow together around restorative processes. So we have yielded great results in terms of moving towards this. And at the same time, I remind people that change takes time and it's a process. But it's been a voluntary invitation to engage in this process. This has not been necessarily a mandate. So we have schools, we have teachers, school leaders, who parents, community members who are asking for this process. You know, we're not shoving it down their throat. They're mm-hmm. calling and requesting and making a demand to say, we need to do something different. We all long for connections. This is a great way to build that connection, to reconnect us, because we have been so disconnected, and to be able to hear each other's stories in a fresh way. And once we understand and hear each other, we're more likely to do less harm to each other. So that's the concept behind our restorative process. So again, we're very encouraged at the great feedback that we're getting and the results that we're seeing at various schools and community partnerships.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour. Hal, we're coming to you on the phones right when we come back, and I've got a couple of emails we'll read, and we'll continue to hear the stories and the experience of Dominic Barter, who is the creator of Restorative Circles, created that process in Rio de Janeiro about 21 years ago and is making his third visit to Rochester. He has traveled around the world taking this process there, and you're hearing how it works this hour on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, 240 years ago this week, George Washington led an attack on Princeton, a second surprise victory against the British that helped turn the war effort around. In fact, it kept a lot of the soldiers who had signed up for the war still serving in the American cause. How did he make those decisions? We're going to talk about that next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I promise you, if you go to 220 Winton Road South tomorrow at 7 p.m., you will find this event with Dominic Barter. It's the first Unitarian church. I might have added a Universalist, because I always do the Unitarian Universalist together.
So, it was my bad. It's on the flyer. Sorry, everybody.
I host the show, Kit. I'll take responsibility.
We can argue over it, Evan. And Dominic is here to help us.
Yeah, well, bottom line is, if you go to 220 Winton Road South tomorrow, 7 p.m., Medicine for Hate, a Restorative Response with Dominic Barter, that's where it is. Hal in West Sparta is on the phone first. Go ahead, Hal.
Hi. Thank you, Kit and Dominic, as well as the host. This is a topic near and dear to me. I think of it as, in a prevention sort of sense, like there's primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. I mentioned to the screener, having volunteered with a Quaker group in a local state prison, and in just listening to a dozen or so more gentlemen in the prison, I realized how wildly violent, unpredictable, and impulsive their childhoods were, and many of them were spending the rest of their lives missing their family. So I guess what I was wondering is, on the primary and secondary level, or even in public schools as part of a curriculum, even if it wasn't called restorative justice, this sense of listening and understanding is really a skill set that social learning might allow. Is there some way to do this other than waiting for someone to go into the school-prison pipeline? The host has done an excellent program on the lack of diversity in inner-city teachers, providing role models to listen to children's experiences. But I'd be curious if Kit or Dominic could speak to the prevention and early prevention, how these should just be general skill sets, and that's a very technical way of referring to it. I mean, just being able to listen and care and empathize is something that often doesn't come about when people are looking at smartphones starting at a very small, early age.
Hal, thanks for the phone call. Yeah, a lot there. Why don't we start with that? We're actually going to start with Ruth Turner, who is with the Rochester City School District. She's the Executive Director of Student Support Services, and then we'll open it up as well. Go ahead, Ruth.
I mean, I agree, and I think that's what we're endeavoring to do. We're not only sharing the process with our staff, but with the parents that we work with, our community partners, daycares, early childhood, just every and anywhere in which we can teach these skills early on so that it becomes a part of an individual's everyday process on communicating, being empathetic and deep listening. And understanding. So I absolutely agree we're aware of that. And that's why our focus, also focusing on children and youth, giving them a voice and helping them understand the process and taking ownership, as Dominique mentioned, that there is choice. There's always choice, and being aware of what that choice is and how to facilitate making that decision. So, yeah, I agree with Hal that this is something that we need to be intentional in making sure that it's part of our social learning process.
Mm-hmm. Dominic?
I was quite touched, Hal, when you mentioned the prisons. The day I left to come here, we had a big disturbance in a prison in Brazil. We lost 56 of the inmates died in that disturbance. And just this morning when I woke up, I received a text message from one of the judges who has to go back to work now and meet the prisoners who ended the lives of so many of their colleagues. And it's really judges who are at the forefront of a lot of the changes that we're seeing with restorative justice in Brazil in the moment, including the changes in the law that we've recently had that have greatly increased the access that we are now able to give to restorative practices in prisons and with youth courts and stuff. And he was talking about the fact, I'm actually reading this now, he's talking about how he needs to go back to these prisoners and see them as human beings despite all the things that they've done. And that's why he needs restorative practices, not simply because he's trying to make some change in their lives, but in order to actually preserve his own ability to feel and to see them in their humanity. And that, as you're saying, that doesn't need to occur simply when something painful has happened. That can be part of a larger change in the culture. So when I hear Ruth talking about the changes that are happening in schools, and I see the work that Kit is doing, reaching out on a community basis with the same logic and the same practices, then I feel very, very hopeful that these are small parts, what each of the three of us are doing, are small parts in a much wider change, which is bringing back the idea of safe spaces for dialogue as being an essential aspect of any family, any workplace, any community gathering, any church, any school, anywhere where we're living together. Because whenever we get together as human beings, we will experience conflict for really good reasons, because we care. We care about each other. We care about justice. We never fight with people we don't care about. We never fight about issues that aren't important to us. So wherever we're together, we get into an experience of conflict, and learning how to do that in a way that makes sense so that children can grow up and see, all right, so these adults aren't frightened of having differences and disagreements. They know how to do this. Then the society gets a lot safer for the future.
Got an email from a listener named Jack who says, Evan, everything that you're talking about with your guest today sounds great, but I'm afraid it sounds like a fantasy. I would love for you to ask your guest, how, with this practice, especially in a school, can you maintain order and control? Dominic?
Sure. Well, first thing I'd like to say is that I wish I could show you how much more I fail than I have success at this process. I think that would immediately help you get a sense that this isn't a fantasy. This is research. We're working it out slowly, making mistakes all the time and growing and learning from mistakes. And so is everybody else in this huge movement of restorative justice all around the world. Secondly, I want to think a lot about my objectives when I'm in a school situation. I've been a teacher. Now I'm part of the direction of a part of the administration of a school, and I'm thinking a lot about what my fundamental objectives are. And of course, I want the things that order and control can bring. And yet often the strategies for gaining control or maintaining control that I was brought up with are not effective. I didn't enjoy them when I was a student, and I didn't enjoy them when I was a teacher. So I'm looking at finding out what are the good reasons why people are doing and saying the things that they're saying. I'm not paying too much attention if they're using Anglo-Saxon language to use it or Latin language to use it. I'm not going to get too head up about the words that we consider bad words. I'm much more interested in why are voices being raised? Because voices are raised when distances are increased, distances of understanding. So if people are raising their voices, if they're using language that we've already agreed that we'd rather not use, if they're making physical contact with each other, then what is this saying? And rather than trying to repress that behavior or marginalize it or say that in some way it is bad, I'm interested in creating a space where it's safe for that behavior to reveal its underlying message. So, oddly enough, in order to increase the sense of control and order in the school, I'm not using the strategies for control and order that I was brought up with. I'm using different strategies. I'm, first of all, asking those conflicts to find another place to be, classrooms dedicated to other activities. Conflict needs shared power. Classrooms are based on a difference in knowledge and life experience. So those two environments, it's really, really tough for them to coexist. So I'm looking at how can we create spaces in the school where it's safe to speak the truth about painful or difficult things, where it's safe to disagree, where when I raise my voice, that's understood as an indication of intensity, of how important this is for me, and not some demonstration of lack of control or responsibility. And that way, what I find is that indirectly, order and control are far more increased for individuals, and I don't need so many strategies to impose things on others. And then life gets a lot easier for teachers. You know, as teachers, we go through so much stress and so much pressure. We transfer it onto kids. No one enjoys being in a classroom with an under-resourced teacher or an under-resourced parent. It's just not fun to be with adults who are not okay. So restorative practices are also based on creating the healthiest environment for the adults. And when they demonstrate their well-being, then the kids learn from them.
Okay, I want to get Emma's question. Emma emailed the program, and let me pull it up here. Emma was asking, said, Evan, this sounds amazing. Can your guest just give us a sense of what it sounds like and how a circle begins? I'm not asking you to recreate anything there, but I would love to know more about what it actually sounds like.
Before we go with Emma's question, I just want to, the earlier listener was Jack.
Yes. Oh, Jack. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And I just want to say, Jack, I would strongly encourage you to just do a little research, because all the research that I've looked at suggests that actually the restorative approaches to conflict are far more effective and far less costly from a dollar standpoint. We did a conference out at RIT supported by the Department of Criminal Justice on this a few years ago, in partnership with Partners in Restorative Initiative. So they're one of the organizations sponsoring Dom's talk tomorrow night, along with the Center for Dispute Settlement. And there's a boatload of evidence now about how much dollars are saved by this approach that Dominic just described, rather than the cost of throwing people away and warehousing them. There's a lot of evidence on this now. I think if we could hit pause and start our criminal justice system over now, with evidence-based, we would absolutely go with restorative, which is why many other countries and some U.S. states are just heading in that direction as fast as their little feet can take them. So I'd love to encourage skeptical listeners to just do some research on the cost benefits of restorative, because they are considerable.
Okay. And Jack, if you want, you can attend tomorrow night at the First Unitarian Church on Winton Road South in Rochester, 7 p.m. Dominic will be there. Kit will be there. It's Medicine for Hate, a Restorative Response. Ruth, what would you say to Jack when it comes to that evidence base? What he's saying is this does sound great if it works. He just can't envision it maintaining order in the classroom. What do you say?
I don't think it's either or, and I think that's the difficult mindset when it comes to educational setting, the sense that if I do this, then I'm giving up something else. It's not that, and it's the highest level of accountability, actually, when we allow each other and young people to come together and discuss how individuals' actions or a group of people's actions has impacted others. It builds empathy and understanding. So how can we go wrong doing that? It's a different way of thinking than we're accustomed to, and oftentimes, even as an early practitioner, it's uncomfortable initially. But the more we do it, the more we practice and see the benefits and see the results, the more likely we're to buy. And so I've heard over and over countless people say, oh, this is crazy. It's not going to work. And what we do, we just invite them. We say we just invite you to experience a circle. And oftentimes, 9 out of 10, once people have an understanding and have experienced it, they are often like, this is what we need. This is what we've been longing for. It's very much connected with somebody in a very humane level, and not looking at what that person has done, but really seeking to understand. Mm-hmm. And in understanding, we build connections, and through connections, we learn to love and respect each other.
Well, and then let's take Emma's question as a logical follow-up, then, what it might actually sound like. And I don't necessarily know that we want to reenact a circle, but Dominic, how would you answer Emma's question?
I'd like Ruth just to say what she just said again. I think that's that's the answer. Those are all the qualities. But I would start off with those three questions that I told you, which we can do with our work colleagues, with our family. We can do that anywhere. You know, what works when we respond to uncomfortable conflict? And what doesn't work so well?
And what are the three questions?
Can I?
Well, those are the first two. What works well? What doesn't work well? And how would you like it to be?
So let me just flip a little bit on my side. So what we've endeavored to do in the Rochester City School District is what we call the 80-20 rule. Spend 80% of our time building communities, 20% addressing wrongdoing. So what that would look like, and you're just in a circle and asking questions. One of my favorite questions with young people is, if you can have any superpower in the world, what would it be and why? And I'll share something with you that one time a student shared with me that just really touched me. The student said, if I could have any superpower, it would be the power to heal, because I've had so many people die in my life, and I want to be able to have the power to bring them back to life or to heal them from trauma or wounds or anything. That's very telling. And, you know, and then we go around and just begin to relate each other on those bases. So you have community building circles that like that. And then you have circles in which you are coming together because there's been a harm done and you're trying to seek ways to repair that harm and to come to a level of understanding. So there's different circles for different occasions. We have circles for celebration. We have academic circles to address academic needs, academic progress. So it could be used anywhere at any time. We have churches asking for training. I mean, anywhere you can imagine, school safety officers asking for the training and trying to incorporate it. So it is not a cookie cutter. It can be used for any occasion at any time for people coming together to say, we just simply want to build connections and have a level of understanding, because then we're not afraid of each other. We're not afraid to go to that side of town. We're not afraid to work in this area. We're not afraid to live in this area, because we've connected on the fact that at the end of the day, we are all human beings having a human experience.
And let me just see if Dominic thinks I'm going on the right path with sort of the intentional aspect of this and then the possible benefits of this. Let's say you have a scenario where someone has stolen something. Someone stole a classmate's or someone in town's brand new pair of shoes, maybe a big deal to this person, stole them. There's a lot of anger, hurt. They're sitting down. And what society tends to start doing is branding that person, you are a thief. You are a criminal. You're not someone who stole. You are a thief. And the society starts telling you, you know, that you are bad, that, you know, we're making a judgment on the character and that sort of in a permanent way. And Does a restorative circle give this chance for the person to be sort of feel like a human being again and to start explaining, well, you know, maybe I stole because, you know, parents are out of work, struggling. It's something I wanted. I feel like I have to have that sort of status. I don't have the means to get it. I didn't want to hurt. I mean, is that part of this process of allowing someone not to be branded in a permanent way that may only reinforce that behavior in the future?
Yeah, labels are really useful for giving very quick information to each other. That's why we use them. But they become really problematic when we believe that that person is the label. That's why all the old traditions have been trying to explain to us for thousands of years, be careful of judgments, be careful of labels.
What if we believe it about ourselves?
Yeah, the same works when we believe it about ourselves. We exclude ourselves, we diminish ourselves, or we reproduce the behavior that other people have told us we will reproduce because of the labels they use about us. So if I'm labeled a thief, I'm labeled a thief. That encourages me to keep on thinking that way and then behave in that way. So the first of all is what Ruth was talking about, is to create community, a sense of community, where it's actually not possible to believe that those labels fully describe someone. But let's say we're in a situation where that hasn't happened yet. So we believe those labels. We had a case recently where two young students were repeatedly taking food from other people's bags at school. And the kids had grown up in that kind of environment, the one that you're describing. So they immediately start labeling their two colleagues as being thieves. And nothing expresses their indignation that this is happening so much as raising their voices, standing up, using physical pressure against these students to try and get them to stop. So it's actually not useful to try and repress that reaction. But at the same time, they're doing that with no understanding about why this is happening. So a restorative circle in that situation was a chance for the kids who'd had their food stolen to be able to speak up about just how furious they were that this was happening. And it was an opportunity for the kids who'd been taking the food to find out the repercussions of what they'd been doing. Because a lot of the way that we do justice in schools or in families or in cities separates the people who've committed an act from the people who've suffered the consequences of it. And that's really, really unhealthy. Because me, as someone who's committed an act, I don't find out how powerful I am. I don't find out that I have the power to make other people's lives really miserable, and therefore to want to think about how I use that power so I can start using it to contribute to their well-being. But it also created an opportunity for those kids who were so angry and upset to hear from these two brothers what was going on. And they found out that in that family, there were six kids, and in that family there was a lottery each morning to find out who would have breakfast, because there just wasn't enough food to go around. And that's happening in increasing ways. In every town, all through this country and all through most of the countries I visit, there are people increasingly marginalized, away from the resources they need in order to be able to have the basic conditions to live well. When their colleagues heard that these two students were coming to school hungry, their reaction was radically different. They were opening their bags. They were sharing their food. Please, please take the food. So the sense of community that wasn't there in the way that I would encourage people to do what Ruth is talking about, create that community first, and then these things won't occur in that way. But if that isn't there, then restorative circles are fabulous at revealing the extent to which community is there waiting for us when we're willing to find it.
All right, we're down to our last few minutes here. What I wanted to ask Dominic before the hour's out is to not only touch a little bit on what Medicine for Hate means to him and what he's going to talk about tomorrow night, but in the context of this. In this country right now, we're at an American moment where I wonder if you feel that restorative practices are maybe losing the national debate. You have a president-elect who talked very openly about policing practices being more aggressive, talks about stop and frisk, has talked about very specific legal justice cases in ways that I think are probably the opposite of restorative practices. He's put people like Rudy Giuliani and others in positions of power that are very much more on the sort of punitive, send a message kind of style. Is this a moment where right now restorative practices is having a tough time in the debate in this country? And how does that tie in to tomorrow night for you?
So language is really, really important. But what I'm focused on when I'm looking at things restoratively is meaning. So I'm not going to get overly distracted by the words that people are using. What I'm really interested in is what fundamental values are they expressing through those words? So there's been a lot of work in the US in recent years, both on the left of the spectrum, politically speaking, and on the right, to discover how restorative practices make sense for people of all kinds of different ideologies. And I think that groundswell of transformation continues, despite the fact that in this moment you're discovering that there are fundamental values in your country, in my understanding, that haven't been taken care of in the last few decades. And those, as happens in Brazil, those begin to shout when they're not listened to. The volume is raised in order to compensate for the distance. So now you have a groundswell of speech which is occurring, people expressing opinions and underlying values that haven't been taken care of. And that's why you're going through a moment of political readjustment. While this is happening, of course, there continues to be, from the margins of society, an ongoing attempt to create more inclusion. So yeah, I would agree with you. This is a huge moment. I think it is in many countries. In Brazil, with our impeachment last year, all kinds of political changes. We're going through something different, but with some similarities. And it's a really interesting time for us to look at how we can recognize anger and hear anger so that it doesn't crystallize into hate. Because hate is not the problem. Hate is what happens when I haven't listened to the seriousness with which someone is objecting to something. What I want to do is bring that hate back into dialogue, like I want to bring any expression of violence back into dialogue and understanding. I want to rediscover how can we create safe spaces in society where everything can be said. How can we find out why our public squares existed in the first place, what these public meeting places were created to contribute to our society, so that listening comes back into the national discourse.
Medicine for Hate, A Restorative Response, with Dominic Barter tomorrow night at the First Unitarian Church on Winton Road South in Rochester. The Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, the First Unitarian Church, the Center for Dispute Settlement, Partners in Restorative Initiatives, all working together not only to bring Dominic here, but put on that event tomorrow night. He's going to be talking to students and teachers today. And I just want to thank you for your generosity, your time, and sharing your background, your experience with us this hour. Thank you for being here, Dominic.
Thank you.
Ruth Turner from RCSD, always a great conversation, and we will have a lot more to talk about as we see, again, more evidence, but also a chance to experience more of the stories and some of the development happening with restorative practice in RCSD. Thank you for being here, Ruth.
Thank you for giving us this opportunity.
And Kit Miller from the Gandhi Institute. Thank you, Kit. Really appreciate the time. All right, short break, more connections next.